You're listening to TIP.
Hey everyone, welcome to this Wednesday's release of the Bitcoin Fundamentals podcast. On today's show, I have two very special guests with Lynn Alden and Elise Killeen. Throughout our conversation, we talk about all the emerging businesses and ideas currently happening in the Bitcoin Lightning Network and where they see the space moving in the coming 12 to 24 months. As any follower of the space knows, Lynn and Elise are two of the most prominent capital allocators and thought leaders there are, and when you put them together, you get some of the most exciting and brilliant insights around. So, without further delay, here's my chat with Lynn and Elise.
You're listening to Bitcoin Fundamentals by the Investors Podcast Network. Now, for your host, Preston Pysh.
Hey everyone, welcome to the show. Very excited to have Lynn and Elise here. I put out a thing on Twitter for questions and I think we got 150 questions for you two. It was very well received and everyone is pumped to hear your thoughts. So guys, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Of course.
Thanks.
It's an honor to have you guys. I just want to start off here. So we're going into 2023. 2022 was some of the most interesting market dynamics I think we've seen in the US in any of our lifetimes, just as far as how poorly everything has performed. As you guys look at 2023 and where we're going, what's your one over the world? Like, what if you were going to summarize for somebody who's maybe not really financially inclined, they're just kind of curious your broader opinions, where do you guys see things moving this year? Elise,
I guess I'll hop on that.
Yeah, go ahead. No, go ahead, Lynn. Go ahead.
I think basically like this current period is like a cyclical disinflation, right? So basically we had two years of massive stimulus, large money supply growth, and then on a lag, we had all the consumer prices growing up very quickly. And then now we have, you know, the Federal Reserve and other central banks coming in trying to tighten that, partial withdrawal of fiscal stimulus as well. And so now we're seeing kind of the hangover of that whole time. We saw that last year, but now we're, I think, continuing it so far, which is basically that we have various, you know, recession signals mounting, or at the very least, economic deceleration and inflation coming off its highs, with the caveat that some of the constraints for the supply side that trigger the inflation are still kind of lurking out there. And so if we have another round of growth, maybe, you know, 2024, 2025, I think some of those inflation pressures will be ready to return.
Elise?
So that affects startups. So the way that startups will be impacted by the macroeconomic environment and trends is that 2023 will be a harder fundraising year than we had seen in the prior few. For Bitcoin companies, though, they'll also benefit from the flight to safety and the stability, which always benefits Bitcoin, but also the companies. An example of this is that although we're in a crypto and Bitcoin bear market and a challenging macro environment, Lightning companies have continued to grow. They've sort of been impervious to any of those external trends. And that will be recognized, I hope, by venture capitalists. And so the funding environment should better receive Bitcoin companies relative to their peers. But nonetheless, people have pulled back in terms of deployment of capital to risk assets, including venture capital. And so there'll be an impact of that. And what we're seeing is companies get ready to sort of bear down and focus on what's core to their long-term growth versus taking, you know, some of the more extravagant shots that were possible in earlier years with the looser fundraising environment.
I like your comment about Lightning, and this is where I wanted to go next, which is your opinion on the state of the Lightning Network, because everything that I'm looking at just seems like it's really building out. Despite the environment that you just described, it seems like there's a whole lot of entrepreneurs plowing into this space, a lot of things being built, but how do you guys view it right now at the start of 2023?
I think that's right. So in 2022, Stillmark made 8 investments. The majority of those were in Lightning infrastructure companies. And that was in preparation it was backing companies that were positioned to reap the rewards of both a scaling Lightning network and a maturing Lightning network. So for example, something that Lynn has talked about a lot is fiat on Lightning network. what sorts of communities, demographics, geographies are going to be keen to have a stable coin on Lightning Network. And we're almost there. We're very close. That'll happen this year. And so companies have had that as a tailwind. So those sorts of opportunities that enterprise is preparing to reap the rewards of, they need the tools developed by Lightning Network infrastructure and enterprise-oriented companies. And so that activity of 2022 and then 2021, preceding that, we will reap some of those rewards this year. And the founders that have been most conservative in spend and focus are going to benefit the most, I think. And so one of the things that we will see this year, I believe, is enterprise get ready, non-Bitcoin enterprise, get ready to seriously test the market. I think we'll see that in Q1, probably. And that will be enabled by companies like Lightning Labs, Voltage, Amboss Technologies, et cetera, because the tools have matured to the point that you won't have to understand the workings of Lightning Network in order to use it. And the technology is beneficial regardless of where the crypto and Bitcoin markets are. So Bitcoin's volatility doesn't do anything to dampen the advantage of instant, nearly free transactions across the globe and across borders.
Yeah, and I think the fact that the Lightning Network is so, it's such a high ratio of utility to speculation. And so when you kind of look at other parts of the crypto ecosystem, they're very speculation heavy. Even when you bring it back to the Bitcoin ecosystem, when you have things like fiat on-ramps and exchanges, you know, there's still going to be somewhat speculation-based, less so, you know, some of it's saving, some of it's investing and speculating. But when you bring it all back to the Lightning Network, that's very, very utility-focused. It's about payments, it's about infrastructure and things like that. And so I think that so far that the fact that it's been rather resilient is not that surprising. If you look back at, say, the 2008 crisis, for example, a lot of the companies that were growing that were later to become very big in the 2010s decade, a lot of them just kept growing from a small base through that difficult macro environment because it's the right product market fit. It's you know, people are buying things that are obviously better than what came before them. And I think we're seeing kind of similar things, some of the more utility focused aspects of the Bitcoin ecosystem, which certainly includes Lightning.
I was going to build off of what Lynn said. So something that happened in 2008 was the emergence of a new platform, mobile, for app development. Mm-hmm. And then also sort of the tailwind of a cheaper entrepreneurial environment enabled by cloud. Lightning does both of those things. Mm-hmm. So Lightning allows for new business models and new types of products to be built the same way that mobile did. So Uber is not possible without mobile smartphones, right? Mm-hmm. There's going to be companies, or are companies being built today, that aren't possible without Lightning Network. They're introducing something new and novel. In addition to that, though, Lightning Network allows companies to operate more efficiently from a cost perspective. And that tailwind was also present in the really productive years of 2008 and 2009 in terms of years that defined culturally relevant companies. And so, of course, that was when Uber emerged, Airbnb, and companies like that. I think that same energy exists here and because of the Lightning Network.
You know, it's interesting. I've been spending a lot of time on the new Nostr protocol and this Damus app, which isn't even out of test flight yet. And I'm seeing exactly what you're talking about, where Will, who's the guy behind the Damus app, he's there programming in SAT tips that are right there. Like if you go on the Twitter and you hit reply or retweet the message, he's got another icon right there where you literally just click it and you can template. Maybe there's 5 sats or 25 sats that goes to that person's tweet that you literally, like, it's all set up in your wallet. You got the LN URLs there that are automatically like making, so you're not creating invoices and things like that. And so people can just literally click on the button and it's sending them sats off the tweet, and it's like zero friction to the user. On top of that, they have like sats, like an encrypted wall of energy around your DMs, like just built into this Damus app. And this is just one client of many clients that are going to compete on this Nostr protocol. And so like I'm seeing the competition and I'm seeing how they're already incorporating this frictionless, borderless payment the servers are decentralized. And so like for people to pay to have these servers, but you need some type of like frictionless fee that isn't KYC'd that you can send over the Lightning. It you can just kind of see it all fitting together in that exact description that you just said, Elise. And this is just one application, right? Like how many other things out there are getting built? And I know you guys are seeing it. And it's just kind of amazing to see. You made the comment first quarter 2023. What do you think the fourth quarter is going to look like? Is it just going to be leaps and bounds, or do you see it kind of progressing a little bit slower?
You said so much there. There's so much to respond to. So, you know, the fourth quarter or you know, the midterm, let's say, I'm really excited about a couple things. So I'll just mention two of them. And one we've talked about already, which is stablecoins on Lightning Network. Mm-hmm. And what that will mean for people in geographies that really need the payment rails. So a non-domestic, non-socioeconomically privileged demographic, what it means to actually be banked by Lightning Network. I think we will understand that better in Q4. The other thing that will be possible is possible now, but I'm hopeful that there'll be more entrepreneur activity taking advantage of this, is the pay per API call model. So it might be less sexy to talk about, but something possible through LSAT, a Lightning Labs protocol. And another company is working on another implementation called C13. It's C13N.io on the web. And what this says is that you can attach a piece of data to a Lightning Network transaction, which will allow you to build economic activity, for instance, around using ChatGPT. So we know that there's a cost for running and providing the service of ChatGPT, which is not being paid in any way now. I guess it's probably, well, I'm not sure how it's subsidized. I'm imagining it's venture subsidized. And that could be monetized for API calls and in a way that the user base didn't even need to really think about it much. So we wouldn't think about spending a penny, two, three, four, or five on, you know, pulling up an image or response to a question. And that's possible without that and with other technologies, like I referenced with C13. And so I'm hopeful that we'll see new business models emerge and new product types leveraging that technology, which is possible through Lightning Network.
Lynn, any other comments on that one?
So I think a narrative that we're seeing is that, you know, during the whole kind of quote unquote Web3 thing that was happening, basically everything had a token associated with it. And basically that was just kind of like a lot of projects trying to get paid up front, whether or not the underlying project ends up delivering anything durable, basically fast. That's the liquidity's, you know, ability to try to just everybody do seniorage. And what we're kind of seeing lately is the idea that a decentralized web is a good thing. It's just that you don't need your own token attached to it. So we've seen, I mean, you mentioned Noster. There's also the whole Keep /tags, you know, that vector. There's Web5, right? There's multiple different kind of angles here, and we'll see how some fit together or compete with each other over time. But the point is, you know, it's just basically showing that when there's actually a good product market fit, the product sells itself. You don't need to like add unnecessary gambling to it, try to get out of the position quicker. You're actually building something of value. And then the fact that there's this common money associated with it also allows for monetization in the normal way. Kind of like if you invent like Uber app, you don't have to invent like another one with its own money, right? Dollars are fine, or obviously, you know, Lightning would be great, but like basically you don't need to like reinvent money every time you reinvent like a new service. And I think we're seeing that play out in the kind of the Bitcoin focused, you know, kind of decentralized web applications that have been getting some momentum lately.
Yeah, the whole... go ahead, Elise.
The other benefit is that founders will have real information in their metrics. Yeah. So when they look at adoption, they won't need to try to disentangle the gambling incentive created by a token or the speculative incentive created by a token. They'll just know, you know, how their choices are received by users and where the value is. Sorry to have interrupted you, Preston.
No. You didn't interrupt me at all. I was just going to comment on Lynn's, her comment on the Keat. So I tried that out and it was mind blowing how well this works, and to think that there's no server that's that was like hosting, like centralized server that was hosting that video chat. For people that are listening that aren't familiar with Keep, Paulo is the guy that put it together. And I mean, this is peer-to-peer video teleconferencing. We're not using it right now because I don't know how to record with it. And I just haven't really played around with it. And I like to sometimes share my screen to pull up charts and stuff. But for anybody who's tried it out, it's kind of mind-blowing how high quality the video is. It's better than this video we're using right now, which doesn't seem like that would be possible. And just as I'm sorry to talk so much here, there's just so many neat things happening. So I shot a message to Paulo on Twitter and asked him about, is there a way to basically do Twitter spaces over the Nostr protocol using this hole punch technology that he's working on? He replies back to me. He's like, actually, we're working on exactly that right now. And so when you're looking at like, how are all these things, like they're being paid for by the creators right now. Like if you're running a relay on Nostr, you're basically paying out of pocket to do it because we're at the infancy stage. But where it's going next is you pretty much have to be using Lightning to be funding some of these things for the zero fee, near frictionless streaming of money. It's just fascinating. I want to push back a little bit on the Taro piece. So like you guys, I think that the stable coins are very important moving forward, especially in the developed world where maybe bills are denominated in dollars or euros or whatever. I think that it's a really important piece. I had a conversation with Pierre Richard. He was a little bit more skeptical. He saw it as a distraction on Lightning. I'm curious if you guys would agree with that. And let me tell you his rationale. His rationale was it's centralized. Any token you do is going to be a centralized, you know, you have some type of ledger entry that is being centralized and controlled by some entity. So why waste our time focusing with it on Lightning when we can just focus on Bitcoin on Lightning and let all the other people, entities worry about the centralized tokens and what all that brings? I'm kind of curious if you guys would agree with that or if you see it a little bit differently.
I guess I'll jump in. So I see that view, but I think it's a somewhat privileged position, right? So for example, all of us on this call, we have access to dollars. It's not really a problem for us. We can just do our normal day-to-day activities with dollars, and then we can save and use Bitcoin in however way we want, and it's fine with the volatility. But a common thing that comes up when you look at these small communities that are building out around the world, these little Bitcoin communities, a common thing that comes up is, hey, we need dollars too. And you know, the ones that are doing it correctly, they acknowledge that their dollars are centralized. And the whole point is that the central hub is outside of their country. So for example, let's say you're in Argentina, you know, I've seen it described as someone says, okay, I hold local currency for 1 month's worth of expenses. I hold, you know, stable coins for several months worth of kind of intermediate term savings. And if I want to put savings away for years, I put it into something like Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. And from the perspective of, say, an Argentinian, you know, they've had a history of if you put dollars in the bank, they confiscated. It's hard to get dollars. And so instead of what they do is say, okay, I'll hold dollars. They're centralized, but the central hub is outside of Argentina, right? So unless the United States goes after it, or unless there's, you know, there's fraud, there's counterparty risk, those are real risks to be concerned about, but the central hub is outside of that particular country. And so there is so far been a pretty strong demand for dollars by a number of people in emerging markets in these spaces. And basically the technology allows them to move around faster and in a more peer-to-peer way. And so far they've kind of shifted around to different blockchains. So obviously they started on top of Bitcoin. A lot of them migrated over to Ethereum. That's most used for trading, right? Because it's higher fees, bigger amounts. Whereas a lot of the spending dollars moved over to Tron. And basically, a lot of these spaces say, okay, I want to have stable coins, but I don't really want like another token associated with it. I don't, you know, if I'm using a centralized stable coin, I don't need a whole another centralized layer to deal with. And there are different alternatives to how to do that. There's the Taro proposal, which is basically the idea of running them over, using the liquidity, the edge liquidity of the Lightning Network to run them over. There's also, you know, proposals like Peer Credit, which is basically using like a Lightning-like ledger that's not actually on Lightning to move around those dollars. And we'll see what kind of market things end up winning. But I think it's clear that there is a demand out there for dollars, at least as an intermediate term thing, because, you know, not everybody can deal with, you know, 70-80% drawdowns on 100% of the money that they're using.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Have you ever wondered if there's an AI tool like ChatGPT specifically built for the stock market? a tool that not only aids you in your research and analysis process, but also allows for dynamic discussions. Today, I want to share such a tool with you called Meka. Meka is the AI-powered stock research assistant now enhanced with real-time stock data. Meka does a lot of the heavy lifting of sifting through financial statements and company data and delivers it to you nearly instantaneously, and the best part is that it's 100% free. Try it out today and ask Meka questions like, what is the financial health of Microsoft? How much cash does Copart hold on its balance sheet? What is the return on invested capital of Adobe, or millions of other prompts? Check it out today for free at Meka.com. That's Meyka.com. The dream of owning a vacation home can be daunting. From finding the best guests, to the maintenance, to organizing the cleaners after every guest stay. With Vacasa, they make that dream into a reality. As a full-service vacation home management company with vacation homes in key destinations across the U.S., they know how to make owning a vacation home easy and profitable. On top of proactive property maintenance visits by professional local teams, a data-driven booking platform, and around-the-clock support, homeowners earn on average 20% or more revenue from their vacation homes. Vacasa makes vacation home ownership easy. If you're looking to make more from your vacation home by doing less, partner with Vacasa at Vacasa.com. That's Vacasa.com to get started on your dream of owning a vacation home. Do you guys ever feel overwhelmed with all that's going on in the markets and you feel like you just can't keep up with the day-to-day news headlines? Today's show sponsor, Yahoo Finance, is my go-to solution to keeping up with today's top news and stay informed with what's happening globally. With Yahoo Finance, I'm able to see the biggest trends and biggest movers in the stock market, what's happening with interest rates, major geopolitical events, and much more. If it wasn't for Yahoo Finance, I would have no idea that Tesla is laying off 10% of their staff, or why iPhone shipments are down 9% year over year. Yahoo Finance also has a number of other cool features, including a tool that lets you link in all of your investment accounts, analyst ratings and independent research, as well as the ability to create customized charts. Yahoo Finance is one of my favorite tools that I use in my investing toolkit, and it's what I read each morning to kick off my day to stay in the loop with what's happening in the markets. Join more than 90 million monthly users today and get comprehensive financial news and analysis at yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
All right, back to the show.
No one can deal with that. So there's also, we need to consider the net change in risk between holding dollars in another way and dollars on Lightning Network. So fiat is centralized, and fiat on Lightning Network will have elements of centralization too. But people don't just need dollars. They need to be banked, and they need a way to make payments. And so in a world where people want to spend beyond the cash in their pocket and be able to reach beyond that to engage, for example, in global e-commerce, if they don't have a debit card or a credit card, they have Lightning. Right now, they have to use BTC and tolerate BTC's volatility in order to use Lightning, or at least to, you know, at least to hold their change. And this will allow them to not need to take on the friction of that volatility in order to be banked. And the feedback was really clear in the experiment in El Salvador. So Q4 2021, there's this BTC airdrop in El Salvador to most Salvadoran adult. People used the Bitcoin, and the feedback in labs got from that. This activity was primarily happening on LND. And drew IBEX Mercado's infrastructure support of merchants. And the feedback from that was really clear. We need these rails. We want to be connected to the rest of the world. There, half of the country is unbanked, right? But more than 3 million people use the Lightning Network, meaning that more people were banked in El Salvador during that period through Lightning Network than through the region's banks. And that's meaningful. We can't ignore that. But the sort of additional benefit is that it's a Trojan horse of Bitcoin and a Lightning wallet onto people's phones when they're simply using it for the rails. But as they start to trust the tech, perhaps then they also start to take a chance on saving in Bitcoin. So the tech piece is important, and I think it leaves us in a net place where dollars on Lightning Network are better than not, because we're not introducing new technical risk, or at least that's the aim in development. Development in the Bitcoin space is really rigorous. That's true also in Lightning Network. And so if we can get to a place of stable coins on Lightning Network without additional technical risk for folks using it, then I think we've only added value and Trojan horse in a Lightning wallet into people's lives.
I was kind of expecting, and we had heard rumblings that there was going to be more countries similar to like El Salvador make announcements like theirs in 2022. Nothing seemed to really materialize. Do you see that happening in 2023? Where are you seeing the next big Lightning push coming from or emerging from in the world?
I actually think bottom up is more interesting, right? So all of the El Salvador experiments so far was spearheaded by Bitcoin Beach, which was a more grassroots kind of, you know, local high density, rather than, you know, trying to do a top down thing. And obviously, I think legal tender is great because it takes away the transaction, like taxes, especially, and things like that. So obviously, I would like to see countries do that. But I think that you can't just wait for countries to, you know, acknowledge the interesting aspects of the network and then, you know, move forward with that. That's kind of a special case because they're already dollarized. There's not that many dollarized countries out there. But instead, I think what's interesting is you're seeing, like, you know, Bitcoin Lake, Bitcoin Island, you know, Bitcoin community pop up in Vietnam, for example. There's all these like small other replicants of Bitcoin Beach on somewhat smaller scales. And there's other companies coming out trying to spearhead more of those as well. And so I think those community approaches, where you basically find a smaller, denser population of interest and make sure merchants actually know how to use it, make sure the people actually know how to use it, kind of build that critical mass in a smaller space, I think that's where things are going to come from. I'd rather see 1,000 of those, you know, each with, you know, thousands of people, compared to these top-down nation implementations that then, you know, people then are like, well, what is this new money you're imposing on us? What do we have to do? And again, that's not even necessarily criticizing El Salvador. It's saying it really started from Bitcoin Beach. And I just think you need to see more of the smaller ones. And I think look there. And if you see a bunch of them be really successful in some of those countries, then you might see, much like El Salvador, you might see then a top-down acknowledgement of some of the work that's been going on there, and you might see some countries embrace that.
Right. You want to see people adopting it for the right reasons, because they feel that they're getting value from what they're using. And so I think that, you know, everything that Lynn said really resonates with me as well. Something that we're watching is the geographies that are adopting or allowing the healthy presence of Bitcoin mining. There's a big opportunity in Africa, and we've also seen sort of native community-orientated and motivated adoption of both Lightning Network and Bitcoin in various regions in Africa, which is, you know, really positive, I think, a very healthy form of adoption and one that's sustainable. Something that differentiates Bitcoin, of course, from crypto is the drive for sustainable adoption versus just trendy adoption that needs to be maintained by continuing to introduce new, flashier objects. Bitcoin doesn't do that. It looks for who needs it and long term. And so we're certainly seeing that, especially in lower socioeconomic status communities that are unbanked. And that's where you would expect to see it first. And now I'm talking about adoption of the actual technology versus diversification of a portfolio into Bitcoin. So anyhow, I agree with Lynn. I never spoke about nation state adoption because it wasn't something that I had heard much about beyond the rumors, although I hope that El Salvador gets a benefit of going in early. But what we're really interested in is seeing people find value from Bitcoin technologies and Bitcoin itself. And that's not going to come from nation state adoption per se, but from the introduction of products that resonate.
And I really like the work that, for example, Gridless is doing. And I mentioned that in my latest update, my Bitcoin Energy article, because, you know, there's all that untapped energy out there. Right. So all these like small rivers and things like that. And it's actually really cool to see those. Again, that's another example of a bottom up community. Mm-hmm. And you know, before I saw that example, if you asked me, you know, what is going to come first, wallet, you know, these like communities built around wallets or mining, I would say probably the wallet ones. But I would love to see more and more of these mining communities pop up in places where it makes sense. And it's kind of a more complete integration. And I remember reading Ross Stevens' his 2020 shareholder letter, and he talked about Bitcoin quite heavily in it. And he talked about the idea of in the future, you know, basically Bitcoin enables kind of like how human settlements happen around coasts and rivers. Bitcoin is this unique, you know, consumer of energy that can go to where the energy is in a way that most other things can't. And then by extension, you can have settlements built around those uses of energy. You can build out infrastructure from there. And he even mentioned that he thought in the future it'd be very hydro-based. Talk about Africa. And it's actually really fascinating to go back and read what he wrote. You know, I think it was late 2020 to kind of, you know, go forward and see what kind of work is being done in Africa with Gridless. It's essentially the vision he laid out. So I'm hopeful for it, and I'm happy to see that kind of thing happening.
So Lynn, you said that you saw it more on the wallet side and not necessarily on the energy mining side. Do you have a different opinion on that now? Do you think that that's flip-flopped and that the ground, you know, going from the ground up with how everything's going to be constructed and built is going to be around the energy?
So I hope so. Basically, the challenge with mining in general is that it's always trickier when you're going into jurisdictions where there's less stable rule of law. Mm-hmm. If you're doing something that's capital intensive, mm-hmm. if you're doing something software oriented, it's a lower, you know, kind of just overall commitment. Whereas if you're doing something hardware focused, especially on a bigger scale, that's a challenge. And yeah. with traditional miners, you have to go where the minerals are. You don't really have a choice. And a lot of those are in more challenging jurisdictions. Whereas with Bitcoin, you know, low cost energy, stranded energy is a pretty evenly distributed resource globally. There's a lot of pockets of it in very different types. But some of them, if they're capital intensive, they might say, well, we're not going to go there. It's too much hurdles, too much frictions. And I think the main way around that, it has to be bottom up. It has to be these smaller scale interested communities, people doing it for the right reason. So I think that's the one spear they can kind of go through that kind of dilemma and start building it up. So it's one of those things where when I wrote my initial Bitcoin energy piece in 2021, I mentioned that idea because I, you know, Alex Gladstein was writing about that. I had read the Ross Stevens piece. I was just like, you know, this is something I would like to see Bitcoin miners as a way to bootstrap, you know, act as initial buyers of some of this useful clean energy. And when I wrote that as more of a hopeful statement, I was like, I'm not sure how quickly we'll see that, if we'll see it on a significant scale or not. And so certainly seeing what Gridless is doing, you know, it's certainly like it's further advancing that vision. And so I think it's great to see, and I hope you see more of it in more places.
For people not familiar with Gridless, just quickly give us a one over the world on what they're doing.
Elise, do you want to do it or you want me to mention it?
Well, I'd love to hear it from you. Maybe you can you do part A, I'll do part B.
So Gridless is basically in Africa, they've been doing river mining where they partner and they act as an initial buyer. And basically when you look at electrical infrastructure, there's a chicken and the egg problem, because if you have an untapped energy source, like let's say a river, you know, you can use that to generate electricity, but there's nobody there to consume it. And you're not sure what, you know, if you're going to be able to monetize electricity or not. And the reason people aren't there is because there's no infrastructure. So you have a chicken and the egg problem. And so one way to bootstrap this, and this is something that people have been talking about for years, is that the initial buyer, essentially a guaranteed buyer, can be Bitcoin miners. Mm-hmm. So you can build like a river, a small river dam, generate electricity, attach mining to it. You then have a small settlement, you know, the people running the mine, essentially their families. And then you have this surplus electricity that's happening. And then other people can come in and move it. And eventually, if that electricity gets more in demand and the price goes up, then Bitcoin miners can dial down, they can move elsewhere based on market pricing and go to where there's maybe another untapped source to you know, be an initial buyer for. And so basically Gridless is doing that number of locations in Africa with these very small river based mining. And I think it's fascinating.
Yes, so that is exactly right. Gridless was Stillmark's most recent investment. So Stillmark and Block co-led an investment in Gridless. And for the reasons that Lynn just outlined, What's happening in Africa is that half of the population doesn't have household electricity. And there's folks that don't have stable access to household electricity. And when your electricity is down or you don't have it, it's instantly noticeable. So the politicians are also paying attention because it's one of the first things that people are going to complain about or measure their local government by is access to electricity. Now, at the same time as there's this urgency and need recognized by both people and the government to better electrify the region, there's capital on the sidelines to build out this infrastructure. But here's the problem. Lynn pointed it out. I'm going to underscore it. The initial demand for offtake of this new generation is unpredictable and unstable. And so to be able to measure how much to build and to be able to build for 5 years out, but also recoup your investment in the initial generation has been really difficult and has slowed the cadence of new generation development. And so the founders at Gridless, it's a team of three, Eric, Philip, and Janet. What Janet realized after years of thinking about this problem and how to make a change was that Satoshi had not just introduced sort of an open and free, free to access opt-in financial network that connects all of us, but he had also introduced, he or she or they had also introduced a business model that could be used to electrify Africa. So we've tried everything else, right, to bring renewables online and to electrify regions that are off the grid. We've tried, you know, nonprofit organization and sort of all the other tricks. And now with Bitcoin mining, we're going to be able to try capitalism and just investment. And so that's what Gridless saw and what they're going to take a shot at. So it starts in this small river power generation, and they'll be able to scale it up. Africa, of course, has almost unlimited solar power, opportunities for wind, geothermal, in addition to this run of river generation. And this is a team that, you know, they're not novices. They built a few different things, including hardware intensive businesses. And so we're hopeful here that this is sort of a double bottom line opportunity, which is an opportunity to make a lot of money through Bitcoin mining while also doing good by helping to bring households online to electricity and to incentivize investment in that.
Yeah, I guess the thing that I really like about it. So Alex Gladstein just had an amazing article about the IMF and the World Bank and how it basically goes into these locations and turns all the domestic product into this one focused thing and how it really kind of destroys the local economy. When we look at what you guys are describing, this is starting with the energy, which is the most important thing to be able to do any type of commerce or any type of economic activity. And it's getting the wheels turning and it's getting that in motion. And then it's like whatever their environment in these small local communities is most productive doing, they're now going to have an opportunity to perform whatever that is because they have electricity and they have energy in order to harness. So very, very exciting stuff. This one's a little bit different, a little bit pivot. Lynn, you've been talking, tweeting about the inflation rates in places like Egypt and Argentina. And one of the people that commented on Twitter was interested to hear your thoughts on this going into 2023 for the rest of the year, the impact on emerging market equities, global FX in general, and then maybe kind of how that plays into Bitcoin. And we were talking about stable coins earlier. So if you're holding any of the currencies in these locations, I mean, we're talking about inflation rates of like 80% to 100%. So what are your thoughts?
So one of the defining characteristics of emerging markets from a financial perspective, I mean, you know, the official terminology has a bunch of metrics that they look at, but for financial reasoning, it kind of comes down to whether or not a lot of their debt is issued in dollars or their local currency. So for example, in the United States, Canada, Japan, basically developed countries, the debt is denominated in that country's own currency. Mm-hmm. Whereas in emerging market, they're unable to get the vast majority of their financing in their local currency, mm-hmm. and they have to borrow in what is termed hard money, basically money they can't print. So it's usually dollars. It could also be euros. And in many cases, sometimes it's yen. It's usually dollars. And there's something like, according to the BIS, $13 trillion of dollar-denominated debt in entities outside of the United States. And so, and that's mostly not owed to the United States. It's owed to entities in China, entities in Europe, entities in Japan. And so there's all this dollar-denominated debt. And the problem is, when you have a year like 2022, where the Fed tightens very aggressively, they tighten their monetary policy very aggressively, that strengthens the dollar. And so imagine all of your liabilities suddenly getting harder compared to the currency that your cash flow comes in. And so any of these countries that have fairly low reserves and fairly high dollar-denominated debts run into currency crises or debt crises whenever they have these rapid dollar strengthening cycles. Mm-hmm. And so that's happened to Argentina, that's happened to Turkey, that's happened to Egypt, it's happened to a number of countries throughout Africa. And the Egypt case in particular, I mean, I have family and friends there. They had in 2016, practically overnight, the Egyptian pound was like cut in half relative to the dollar. So for example, I had a friend who was like saving for a house and suddenly just he woke up and there's this, he has like half of his house savings are like gone in purchasing power terms. And then now they're going through the same thing again, where they had a really sharp, it was a three-step currency devaluation. It was kind of a planned, you know, it's basically like, you know, they eventually had to do it, but they did it, the central bank did it on a timing that they, you know, they kind of pulled the Band-Aid off. And so you had these stepwise devaluations. And so you go from like 15 Egyptian pounds to the dollar to, you know, 30 Egyptian pounds to the dollar in a very short period of time. I'm hopeful that some of this, the rate of this happening is behind us, at least in this cycle, because you don't have the Fed, for example, tightening as fast in 2023 mm-hmm. as they did in 2022. But some of them are still very much lingering. And Turkey still has runaway inflation. Argentina still has runaway inflation. And even if they partially get them under control, the underlying problems are unfixed. So sometimes it's the local jurisdiction doing something wrong. But then a lot of it goes back to just the way the system's constructed. And Alex Glassman had a really good, she had like a 20,000 word piece on the IMF, the World Bank, and kind mm-hmm. of the whole cycle of like, you know, modern day monetary, like neocolonialism that we keep turning the wheels on. So a lot of it is that these core countries are pushing volatility to those periphery countries. And so sometimes you can blame them. Sometimes you can blame the developed countries. But either way, a lot of people in these jurisdictions just get racked with constant inflation, negative real yields, devalued savings, and all sorts of impairments on the ability to be banked and do trade. And when I was looking at this, I was also looking at, so in Egypt, for example, and a lot of these other countries, you get high interest rates, which are still usually below that inflation rate, but you get high interest rates. But if you're unbanked and you just have your physical savings, you don't even get those high interest rates. Mm. So if you're getting 20, 30, 40% inflation, and you would be getting 10, 15, 20% yields, at least offset some of that in a bank, you don't even get that. And yeah. So it's just dreadful.
And it's not even just the IMF and the World Bank. I think the China Belt and Road Initiative is basically yeah. the same exact thing as the IMF and World Bank, only maybe even worse, probably worse. So you have not only just one kind of driving it just from the West, but you also have it driving it from the East. And it's just for a lot of these nation states, it's crazy. Does that speed up Bitcoin adoption? Because I would think it's easier to start saving in Bitcoin or at least storing some of your wealth in Bitcoin Lightning than to try to find some type of stablecoin provider via Binance or whatever. I'm just naming that one because I think that's the largest one. I'm kind of curious to hear your thoughts there. But does this expedite people's run to Bitcoin because it's so easy to become banked and to get away from these currencies, these local currencies that have so much dollar denominated debt or euro denominated debt, that's a disaster for them?
So Chainalysis does their like a crypto adoption index, and they don't necessarily break it down by, you know, Bitcoin only, but they do their crypto adoption index mm-hmm. and they update it once in a while. And like, you know, 2 years ago, it was something like 19 out of 20 of the countries on their top 20 mm-hmm. were emerging markets. And the latest one was 18 out of 20.
That's crazy.
And the United States was the one exception 1 year. And I think the latest one was the United States and United Kingdom. But basically, you know, people in developing countries generally get this idea a lot more intuitively than a lot of people that don't have a monetary problem that's as much in their face, that basically have high banking rates, have less unstable currencies. And you don't always see it going to Bitcoin, though. You see it also going to stablecoins, which kind of ties back into the prior thing that they often reach for what they know. Sometimes it's stablecoins, sometimes it's Bitcoin. In Egypt, for example, overall crypto usage, including Bitcoin and stablecoins, is still quite low despite their currency problems. Mm-hmm. Whereas ones where, and I think that's partially because if you have stepwise devaluations, you can kind of ignore it for a while, and then it all happens at once, and you kind of like say, well, this happened. So, and you kind of go back to normal. Whereas if you're like in Argentina or Nigeria or Turkey, and it's kind of, it's a grinding year, they seem to gravitate towards it quicker. And so I'm not sure fully why some countries gravitate more towards others, but essentially this shows straight up the utility reasons why so many people want a money that their local jurisdiction can't provide, whether it's dollars, whether it's Bitcoin, you know, whatever it is. Depending on the person, they do want something else besides what they have on offer locally.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
As many of you know, I love studying businesses and networking with business owners. The more I've studied businesses, the more I've realized that starting and scaling your business is easier than ever because of companies like Shopify. Did you know that Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US? Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify even helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. What I personally love about Shopify is that it's the turnkey solution to kickstart and grow your business, and they are totally committed to giving you the necessary tools to succeed as a business owner. Plus, they have an award-winning customer support team there to help you every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/WSB. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/WSB now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/WSB.
All right, back to the show.
Elise, any follow-up on that?
Other than to note Lynn's insight and brilliance, I'm not sure. So I guess I would say, you know, the way that we can relate to that is just to note that, as was alluded to with the comments on Gridless, the entrepreneurial activity that has insight on the application of Bitcoin to local problems is distributed. Mm-hmm. And so this is why we are going to see companies like Gridless start in Kenya. And I'm hopeful, and we're looking for, as I'm sure you are, companies that see Bitcoin as a solution to the problems experienced in the geographies as Lynn just described them, because having tools to exactly meet those populations' needs, and also to sort of feel comfortable and familiar, which is important, as Lynn pointed out, is valuable and helps companies and products gain adoption. And so, you know, I'm hopeful that we see entrepreneurial activity that speaks to exactly that, which Lynn just outlined, because Bitcoin is certainly a good way to opt out of the instability that makes it hard for people to save or provide long-term for their family.
How do you guys see Fediment playing into this? So we've covered it on the show. I know there's a lot of people in the space talking about it. Sometimes I'll get pushback from people on Twitter saying, oh, that just doesn't make any sense. But I suspect you guys have a little bit of a different vantage point in how this will play out in local communities, and how close-knit a lot of these local communities are in Africa, that places like where Gridless is setting up shop and working. How do you guys see Fediment playing into this?
Well, so Fediment is an opportunity for a new form of onboarding that can be more efficient and culturally suitable for certain populations. And so, and it's also led by someone, by Obi, who deeply understands the Bitcoin space and sort of the diverse set of needs that exist for folks that want to try out Bitcoin. So they're not all going to be, it's not a homogenous group. Bitcoiners aren't people that hold Bitcoin, will continue to become more diverse in their need set, their expectations, and what they know of the world. And Fediment is response to that in a way where it allows a community to come together and leverage the technical adeptness of community members to sort of help them onboard and secure funds. And so it's exciting to see. It's a new, I think, sort of shot at what it'll take to onboard the world to Bitcoin and how to do that in a way that everyone truly has access and also in an affordable way, which has been a sort of long outstanding question of the Bitcoin community, and one where there's been great and rigorous debate, which is, as Bitcoin adoption really picks up and continues to grow, and of course it's happening in a quick clip, does it remain affordable for everyone? I think Fediment is in part an answer to that. I also think Lynn might know Fediment better than I do, so maybe this time I'll hand it to her for the part B of the explanation of the company.
Well, so yeah, Ego Death Capital is a leading investor at Fedi, and so I'm an advisor and investor with them. It's obviously really early stage for Fedi, but I think the technology's right, and I think the founder's right, so I'm very hopeful with what they're going to do. Essentially, what the observation there is that we see these small Bitcoin communities pop up, and we can notice that privacy could be better, right? Basically, if you're running a wallet for a community, the people running it can see a lot more than maybe you'd want as a user. They can see potentially what people are spending their funds on, what they're, you know, who they're receiving from. And Fediment, the idea there, you know, there's both an open source protocol, and then there's also other companies, you know, companies like Fedi or others can build on top of that protocol. And some have made, you know, similar protocols using this technology. But essentially it's 40-year-old line signature technology that allows you to run these small custodial ecosystems in a way that's very private. And it kind of serves two purposes. One is, you know, for these local communities, you can have very inexpensive, tied into the Light network, payments and savings infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And then even the second thing is that even if you're not cost sensitive, right? If you have a hardware wallet, if you're fully, you know, self-custodial, you still might want something like a private spending option, right? You might want to have your savings account, which is your cold card or whatever it might be, your multi-signature. But you still might want like your wallet money in your like Lightning based application that's private and it's easy to use, and you don't have to manage the liquidity yourself. And so there's basically different points of optimization depending on what specifically someone's looking for. And I think, again, it ties back to partially from a position of privilege, but it's also partially looking very long-term and look at how Bitcoin's going to scale. It's going to have to scale in layers. And I think basically the way it's kind of developing is it's almost like a pick your own adventure based on, you know, what you're trying to do with it, what resources you have. You can choose the part of the ecosystem that makes sense for you, right? So if you want to, you know, store $100,000 worth of Bitcoin fully yourself, you can do it in like a hardware wallet. You can do it a multi-signature. You don't really care about the fees too much. But if you're trying to save $100 or $50 or, you know, $200, if you want more privacy, things like that, I think these types of ecosystems are going to be pretty important. And I think this is kind of a really useful tool to have in this kind of global view of these small little Bitcoin communities pop up. And again, it's, you know, the original concept is open source. So it's not even a company in its own right. But of course, there are companies that can build on top of it, which is what we're seeing.
I think the liquidity part's really important that you're talking about, managing channels on Lightning, but then still having ownership of the keys. You know, a lot of people are familiar with like Wallet of Satoshi, where they're basically managing all that for you behind the scenes, and you got to trust that the actors there are good actors. And I think that's where this really kind of comes in at a local level, where maybe you have some close family members and you have some that are good at managing those things, and they can help take care of that liquidity, as maybe a person might have a really small net worth and they need to be able to transact. It really kind of provides, you know, that kind of service. Elise, you don't mind me going down a little bit of a macro path here with Lynn. I have some selfish questions that I'm curious about that I want to get answered. And feel free to chime in if you've got some points of view on here as well. Can you, Lynn, help simplify the Japan situation for people so that anybody listening to this, whether they're into macro or not, why it's so important that we keep talking about this yield curve control jumping up? And the most recent decision that the Bank of Japan made by not raising the yield curve even higher, many suspected it was going to go higher than the 50 bips on the 10-year. How does this really play into like the global situation from an interest rate standpoint? And just kind of explain this in the easiest way so that most people can understand what's going on.
So tying back to my earlier comments about developing countries having their debt denominated in their own currency. Last time we saw the developed world go through like a period that's like now, where you have like over 100% debt to GDP, was like the 1940s. And you had very high debt levels. And what a lot of them did was various types of financial repression, which includes yield curve control. So for example, the United States, the Federal Reserve did yield curve control, where they say, okay, we're not going to let, in addition to controlling the short end of the curve, we're also going to not let the long end of the treasury curve go over a certain amount. And for the United States, that was 2.5%. So inflation averaged something like 6% from the early 40s to the early 50s. It spiked as high as 19%, but they held short-term rates near zero. They held the long end at 2.5%. And the way they do that is they say, we're willing to print money and buy any bond that trades over that yield. Or putting it another way, because bond prices are inverse to yield, any bond that tries to go below a certain price, we're going to buy. And essentially what they try to do is train the private sector to do it for them, because private sector comes to know, if they start to view that as credible, like let's say the yield goes to 2.6%, JP Morgan could come in, buy that, knowing that if it stays above 2.5% for any length of time, they'll be able to sell it to the Fed. Mm-hmm. And they'll be able to make this basically risk-free profit, assuming the Fed actually, you know, sticks by their yield curve control target. And of course, that ends up inflating away a significant part of the debt, because you hold the yields below the inflation rate with basically a limited QE as needed to do it. Mm-hmm. And so fast forward to the modern time, it's, you know, this is the first time since then where we see a lot of developed countries with well over 100% debt to GDP, and Japan's is the highest at over 200% debt to GDP. So they have a very, very large sovereign debt load, and they can't afford significant interest rates on their debt. And they also want to maintain very easy monetary conditions, despite the fact that inflation's above their target. And so they've been doing for a while, they were holding their yields at 0.25%. So the 10-year yield was at 0.25%, even though the rest of the world was hiking their interest rates, even though Japan's inflation was above their official target, they were still holding that really low. And they had to buy quite a lot of bonds in order to hold that at that level. a little while ago, I forget how long ago it was now, time flies so quickly, but they kind of overnight, they expanded that to 0.5%. So they basically let the yields go a little bit higher, 0.5%, which is still below the prevailing inflation rate, below the inflation rate target. And so it's kind of, first of all, it's relevant on a global scale because it's kind of like a canary in the coal mine. We're seeing how some of these very indebted countries can handle this, you know, basically see how hard is it to do, what are the pitfalls that central banks might run into when trying to implement this policy. It certainly wasn't easy in the 40s, and it's not been easy for Japan here in the 2020s. But it's also relevant at global scale for other reasons. One is that, you know, aside from being very indebted, Japan has a very positive net international investment position, meaning that they had decades of current account surpluses, and they use those current account surpluses to go and buy foreign assets. Mm-hmm. So they own, you know, $1 trillion worth of treasuries, the biggest treasury holder, you know, external to the United States. They go out and buy U.S. stocks. They go out and buy European stocks. They go out and buy commodity deposits and things like that around the world. They own a lot more foreign assets than foreigners own of Japanese assets. And, you know, basically when they start to run into a currency crisis, one thing they can do, in addition to manipulating yields and things like that, they can also sell off some of those foreign assets, especially ones that are owned by the central bank, you know, owned by official accounts. And so that another, and then a third thing is that because their rates are so low, a lot of foreign entities have used them as a funding source to then go out and buy foreign assets. And so often what you'll see is that, you know, when U.S. interest rates are also pretty low, you'll see that a lot of Japanese investors will go buy treasuries and then they'll hedge them back and, you know, to take out the dollar risk compared to the yen, and they'll still get a better yield than they can get on their local currency. But lately, because the U.S. interest rate has increased so much, if a Japanese investor wants to buy U.S. treasuries and they want to hedge out the currency risk, that's actually a lower FX hedge yield than what they can get in Japan. And so basically this can kind of ripple through the rest of the global bond market. Part of why they've been able to stay so low is because Japanese yields have been so low. And so we're kind of, this is kind of like a real-time experiment, you know, for the first time in many, many decades, to see a very, very large developed country try to artificially suppress essentially its entire yield curve below the prevailing inflation rate and all the pitfalls that come with that.
Yeah, I read some stuff that Luke Groman puts out there, and he does a great job talking about the FX hedge and how the markets are much more comparable, even though the yields might not look at like it whenever you look at something that's FX hedge. You were mentioning the their ability that they own so much equity in treasuries in the world. Do you find that to be the reason we've seen the dollar sell off so hard here since November? Because they've been basically selling out of that, and it's put a downward drag on the dollar, because the dollar move really has mystified me. And that's the only thing that I've heard that's plausible.
I think around the margin, that's been a contributor. Generally, one thing you see historically is that when the dollar is going up very rapidly, because there's so much dollar denominated debt out there, you'll see a lot of entities sell treasuries or other dollar denominated assets to get dollars to then service their debts. And one thing people forget is that, you know, a lot of people mention this $13 trillion debt figure, but they forget to mention that there's over like $50 trillion worth of U.S. assets held by the foreign sector. And so they have way more assets in aggregate than they have liabilities. And obviously that depends on the jurisdiction. So for example, Turkey has more liabilities than assets. So you know, they're more stuck, whereas an entity like Japan has way more assets than liabilities when it comes to you know, the foreign dollar denominated variety. And so if you're trying, basically the hard part about yield curve control is that if you're trying to manage your yields artificially, the release valve is the currency. So if you hold the yield artificially low, you're going to get your currency weaken more than it otherwise would. But then the third variable they can do, if they have a lot of reserves, is they can also then sell some reserves. And so instead of weakening the currency, they can lower their reserve balance. Mm-hmm. But then that, you know, can damage the asset that they're selling, which in this case might be treasuries. The US like dollar peak coincided with a bottoming in domestic liquidity. So the market started to price in slower rate hikes from the Fed, which has so far been somewhat materializing. And then also the Treasury General Account has drawn down. That gets pretty jargony, but essentially that the Treasury's kind of been partially offsetting some of the QT that the Fed's been doing, possibly in partly in response to this upcoming debt ceiling issue. And so at least temporarily, there's slightly improved domestic liquidity. And then the weaker dollar is giving that global liquidity a little bit of a boost. And so I wouldn't say that all of that's due to Japan, but certainly Japanese selling of treasuries is easily a potential variable to that, because you know, anytime that a large amount of foreign assets get sold from the US, that can cause problems. We've also seen, for example, Switzerland, you know, a lot of these other ones will just stop buying some US equities and stop buying some US assets that they were just endlessly piling into, which is now some reversing. Basically, I think the move got overdone to the upside.
Thank you for all of that. That was amazing. Elise, I had a person online. This was just such a generic question, but I loved it because I think it's an important question to ask. And they're asking about intrinsic value. And, you know, starting off as a value investor and basically large cap companies and trying to calculate intrinsic values like in this Warren Buffett style way, it's so much different than in the venture capital space, which is your expertise. And so I guess the question for you is just, how do you think about intrinsic value as a venture capitalist for this? I didn't write down the person's name. I wish I would have written down their name for it. This person that asked this question on Twitter.
Well, that's a great question. So when you're investing in a company's equity, you have to think about the exit valuation that is possible for the company or the enterprise value. And when you're investing in a token, you don't have to do that. That's the draw for investing in tokens. So in the Bitcoin space, it's the same as in any technology space. Enterprise value is accrued by companies that develop a product for which people have a desire to pay and in a sustainable way. We also need to see growth cadence, and then the company's relative position to competitors. And so those are the sorts of things that start to determine growth stage companies in the private market, their enterprise value. If we're going earlier, where EcoDev or Stillmark are investing now, then what we're really looking at least Stillmark, is the promise of the market. So either the current total addressable market, or TAM, to use an industry acronym, or the expected TAM. And then look at the team's preparation to really be able to either define the market or to compete and win a dominant market position in a market that's already been defined for them. And so in the earlier stages, enterprise value or the valuations you see companies raise at is more of an art than a science. Mm-hmm. And then when you get to growth stage, it's a science. And the growing pains for companies, including Bitcoin companies, is how to move properly from valuations that are based on promise, team, and market into a space where valuations are going to be based on metrics, including growth, market penetration rates, and how you sit against competitors. If you've been able to, and for Bitcoin companies in particular, how you've been able to maintain your growth across quarters, including in bear markets. And so that's how we think about enterprise value. And although we're investing today in really early stage companies, we need to be able to trust and see a path for them to a place where their enterprise value is determined by metrics. So I don't know if that answers the question
of
intrinsic value or not.
I love that. Lynn, did you have any things that you wanted to add to that?
Not particularly. I don't have as much experience as Elise does in that field. The general philosophical difference is that with value investing, you generally are aiming for a higher hit rate. So you want, you know, more companies to each do pretty well. Whereas when you venture in the startup space, you understand that this is, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot more uncertainty there. And so essentially you'll see some companies way outperform their expectations. Other ones, just don't get the momentum that you think they do. And so it's a somewhat different risk model. And yeah. It's, you know, obviously they're not profitable in the very early run usually. And so it's more growth oriented. It's a different style of investing, but either way, any sort of cash flow business that has an expectation of generating future cash flows is ultimately one way or another derived from the expected future cash flows they can produce. But because these are so early stage, you're not really focusing on that in the same degree. anymore focusing on what is the overall size that this market can reach and can they do it in a sustainable way.
Love that. Yeah, it's interesting, the asymmetry of the hit rate early on, you're expecting it to be low, but you're looking for these asymmetric returns. And then on the value investing side, it's more like capital preservation and you're looking for these slight, where the market's just maybe slightly getting the pricing wrong and you're looking for a very high probability of doing that correctly. Great comments there, guys. Okay, this is my last one for you. What is something that you're seeing right now in the market that is, I'm going to say the word pet peeve, but I don't think that that's the right word to use, that you just think people are getting wrong or that they're just totally missing, that you think is a really big deal? Oh, Lynn, I wanted to ask you about the CPI thing. Maybe I might have one more question. But anyway, maybe something that the market's just missing and that's maybe you're passionate about and maybe other people aren't seeing.
It's a great question. So I am going to start with crypto here and say that something that's been really both interesting, disappointing, and maybe I never set the bar low enough, but to see people try to justify the fraud they've committed.
Amen.
Elise. In the search for black box yield has been eye-opening.
Unbound.
And I think, it's hard to predict this because I think, you know, we're to a fault, we assume that others are similar to us or will behave within, parameters, moral parameters that we can understand. And crypto has gone so far beyond that in search for speculation-based returns. And so here's the opportunity that is going to emerge that people will see. So where there's been a collapse in crypto DeFi yield or firms orientated around that, yield generated on the Lightning Network will be able to fill that void. And so here's something that I think people don't understand yet. As Lightning Network has matured and as adoption has grown, that's made way for a LIBOR of the Lightning Network to emerge. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what I mean specifically by that is a reference yield rate for payment utility of Bitcoin payments. And of course, that further financializes BTC, the asset. So the reference rate, this LIBOR of Lightning Network, will reflect the demand for network capacity. And what that means is that as the breadth of utility, the utility set expands for Lightning Network, either through entrepreneur activity, through the launch of assets, including stablecoins on Lightning Network, or as adoption grows through the introduction of, say, more traditional on-ramps, et cetera, that this rate should rise and yield opportunities, it can start to really become compelling. So the current reference rate, as Stilmark measures it through Amboss's Magma Marketplace, is around 3%. And so yield can be, generated to that degree now. And I expect to see that click for people, especially as they start to understand that there was no economic activity underlying this yield generated in crypto and start to look for alternatives to what they lost there.
And that 3% that you're saying there, Elise, this is for basically providing liquidity into the market. Is that how that's being determined? And so we would view that as risk-free.
Right. That's exactly right. So I should have mentioned that at top, and thank you for noting that. So in the crypto space where yield was based on custodial models and generated by speculation, in the Lightning Network, there's this opportunity for yields that is based on economic activity and can be affected through a non-custodial engagement. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of this adult version of crypto yield in terms of it just being mature and sensical. And just to take it down to the basics, and what you all already know is that in Lightning Network, funds are pre-allocated to payment pathways, which enables payment settlement without counterparty risk, yes. Right? And so that pre-allocated capital in those pathways can produce yields. And as the Lightning Network has matured, that's something that exists now that we've yet to really wrap our heads around or see people take full advantage of. And so you asked earlier about Q4, and I talked about paper API call and stablecoins on Lightning Network. I would add this to that response too. It's what can people do with this non-custodial, economically productive based yield, and how will that space develop? And so that's something I'm really excited to see. And I think it's a good maturation of the silliness that we've seen in the crypto yield search.
Love that. Love that. Yeah. The guys over at Amboss seem to be the ones kind of leading the charge with a lot of this stuff. And they're doing a fantastic job. I love their website too, by the way. Lynn,
they're growing quite quickly. So Preston, I always say, if you don't understand Amboss, you don't understand the Lightning Network. Mm-hmm. And I really mean that, but we see incredible growth there. And something I want to mention just to Bitcoiners is that companies like Amboss succeeding in this rapid development of tools is ultimately going to really drive adoption by creating a pathway for enterprise to engage without needing to really get the Lightning Network, like I said before. So it's almost like this abstraction layer of the Lightning Network for folks that know they need this payment efficiency. But beyond that are sort of going to need to set it and forget it for the Lightning Network. Amboss is going to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Lynn?
I try not to think in terms of pet peeves because I view that if the market's misunderstanding something, that's like an opportunity. And basically something that can then, it's kind of like the optimistic spin, like a pet peeve is someone else's opportunity. I still view proof of work as very, very misunderstood, especially with the kind of, you know, the explosion of proof of stake cryptocurrencies and some of the, I think the obfuscations that they make when describing their trade-offs and focusing on, you know, I think the wrong areas. Basically, I think that it remains very underappreciated how much of an innovation proof of work was, especially combined with the details like, you know, difficulty adjustments, small nodes. Basically, what we see most in the crypto space is that every time someone looks at Bitcoin and thinks they can improve it, the thing they throw under the bus is decentralization. They basically make a more centralized thing, which has more bells and whistles. Maybe it's faster, maybe it can do more, but then the cost under the hood for that is that it's centralized in ways that are not always obvious to a user. And so they see it's a cryptocurrency, it's probably just like Bitcoin, but it can do more. But if they don't actually know the nuance, they don't run a node, or if they don't, look at the just the different requirements of the network, if they don't look at, you know, what are the control points on the network, like who has undue influence, who can maybe change the protocol in ways that users wouldn't predict. What happens if the network goes down? How do you determine what the canon state of the ledger was, right? So what is the unforgeable costliness? What is the official state of the prior ledger? And with these other systems, you don't really get those same kind of assurance that you get with Bitcoin. And it's partially is things like first mover advantage. You have liquidity, you have the truly decentralized star, but it's not just, you know, brand and first mover advantage. It's also just the actual way it's designed with purposely small nodes, proof of work of proof of stake. You know, most of the metrics that Satoshi selected were very intentional, and they were, a lot of thought was put into them. And so I think that it just remains very poorly understood, both in the space and then also from, you know, just talking to other macro people, you know, they just kind of look at all the crypto as one big thing a lot of the time. And they, you know, if you say like, what are your thoughts on SegWit or Taproot or just basically it's still a very niche space when you zoom out to the overall macro level. Same thing if you ask about the Lightning Network, if you ask about Taro, if you ask about any of the developments that are happening, they just assume this is some static protocol. All they see is like a price line. You know, they look at a price chart and they think that's Bitcoin, and they don't look under the hood at the development that's happening and why some of the trade-offs are the way they are.
Really fast. This update to the CPI weighting that evidently took place on 1 January, I'm hearing 200 to 300 bips drop in inflation on the next print just due to this weighting update. Do you agree with those numbers, Lynn? And what's the impact of that in treasury markets if we're just magically dropping 2 to 3% off of inflation to previous metrics?
So from what I've seen, I think that was somewhat misreported by some sources. Basically, that some people were looking at it as base effects, that it's going to take in account 1 year instead of like 2 year, and therefore it's going to be a big drop. Instead, what it means is that the frequency with which they update the basket is now going to change more frequently. And so the challenge of measuring in inflation is that everybody's inflation basket is unique, right? So for example, the weight that I spend things on is different than the weight that you spend things on, which is different than the weight that Elise spends things on. And so all of us have like our own unique inflation basket. Like one of us travels way more than others and travel prices are soaring. Another person, you know, spends more on eating out, and that is, say, not soaring, let's say. Then we can have different experiences of how inflation is impacting us. And so what CPI tries to do is it tries to take like a nationwide average of what is the average basket the average consumer is buying, right? So what percentage of their expenditures go towards shelter? What percentage of their expenditures go towards transportation? What percentages go towards food? And they try to construct this, like, you know, quintessential American, like, you know, person. And they say, what is their inflation rate like? And there are various ways to tweak that, and people can debate over it. But essentially what this change is going to do is make that basket update more frequently, which sometimes can cause inflation to come out even hotter than it was before. And other times can cause inflation to, be lower than it otherwise would be with the prior calculation. Basically, if you update the basket every 2 years versus every 1 year, you get slightly different results, even if you're still looking at year over year CPI. And so I don't think we're going to see a giant drop right away, but it certainly can affect the numbers around the margins.
So do we speed it up as it's going down and slow it down as it's going up? Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, one example was,
I'm joking.
So during COVID, for example, people stopped buying a lot of services. They stopped flying. They stopped eating out.
Yeah.
They started buying more electronics. They started renovating their home. They started, you know, doing things like that, buying like the consumer durables. And then once the lockdowns ended and some of the travel restrictions eased, you saw people already bought all the home stuff that they want for the next couple of years. And instead they started flying more and going to hotels more and eating out more. And so you kind of saw that rolling inflation go from those consumer durables to then go to services. And so if you're looking at the basket, how far back you go, impact. If we're spending more on services now, then services are going to have a higher weighting in CPI. Versus if we go back farther and include that period where we're all buying durables goods. And so that is kind of like there is a time component to it, but I think it's overall, it's somewhat overreported, but we'll see.
Okay. I like the contrarian take there. You didn't pile on the bandwagon. I liked it. All right. This is the last one. This is rapid fire. Your book recommendation for people listening in 2023, you can only pick one book. What do you recommend? I love how thoughtful you're being.
Lynn? Are we going to get something from Lynn?
Lynn, what is it? Oh, yeah. Lynn's book is what we're going to recommend.
Lynn's book?
I would like to say that. We'll see if I get it out this year. Writing a book is a challenging undertaking, especially if you're trying to do so many other things. But yeah, I'm biased. And I'll say mine. But funny thing is, by writing it, I've done a lot of research and I've read more books. Sometimes you can find books that you agree with. Sometimes you can find ones that you partially agree with, and you want that opposing another book that you've read, and you want the alternative view. And so one that I've been reading through lately is Debt, the First 5,000 Years. That's been a fun read so far. I've been going back through different essays that people have written. And so it's hard to pick one book. My default is often Lessons of History. Because it's like this 100-page book written
it's
in like the
really
1960s.
Good. Yes, it's
and
really good.
It just covers so many different facets. And it's interesting because what they do is they often describe something and then they'll, like, in the second half of the chapter, they'll flip it around and they'll be like, well, here's another way of looking at it. And then they'll kind of describe it almost like in a contradictory way. And so it's kind of like how you can take the same event and depending on how you look at it, it comes out two very different ways. And like the one caveat that I always say is like, there's one chapter pretty early on that when you start reading it, it comes off like a little bit racist. And it was written in the 60s. But when you get to the later chapter, they kind of flip it around and go back on it. So that's always like the chapter that I kind of warn people about. But basically the book as a whole, it covers so many different facets. And the whole thing it does is it kind of explores just, you know, thousands of years of human civilization. It's like if you condense it into a handful of short observations.
It's amazing how much is accomplished in such a short amount of pages in that book. I've only read it once. I need to go back and reread it. But
yeah, 5,000 years of history, and they do it in about 100 pages.
Yeah.
And it just kind of covers so many different topics.
Lise?
I'll add a couple notes in addition to Lynn's book that we're waiting for. I'd say I always recommend something different than a book, but rereading the Cypherpunk mailing list and understanding the context from which Bitcoin emerged. A lot of the mistakes made in crypto, I think, occur because people in crypto believe that Bitcoin was test zero. It was a starting point for a free digital dollar, and that's not true. It's based on a couple of decades of prior experimentation and failed projects. And the Cypherpunk mailing list really outlines that or brings the value of that forward. Johnny Beer published a book on crypto yield and contrasted it to the yield generation of the Lightning Network that I talked about earlier. The name of the book is escaping me now, but it's Johnny Beer that published it. And then finally, I want to reference a tweet and tag it on to Lynn's pet peeve opportunity of Bitcoin mining. So, and this ties to the recommendation for Cypherpunk mailing list. Hal Finney, in January 27, 2009, said, thinking about how to reduce CO2 emissions from a widespread Bitcoin implementation. So in people misunderstanding proof of work, or in switching from proof of work to proof of stake, they're giving up the opportunity to reduce CO2 emissions and to sort of, use both of the two things that Bitcoin was introduced to do, which is financial freedom and also allowing for renewable and sustainable energy sources to thrive. So going to the Cypherpunk mailing list, getting the insights of people that so deeply understood Bitcoin that they could predict that companies like Gridless would exist all of these years later, I think is never a poor use of time to reread that stuff.
Ladies, what a pleasure having you guys together in this conversation. And I don't know about people listening, but it is so hopeful. Michael has the hope.com. I'm hearing this and I'm just thinking of like what things are going to look like by the end of this year. And a lot of the stuff that you're laying out, it's very exciting. It's going to bring so much hope to the world. And I just can't thank you guys enough for making time to lay a lot of this out and just kind of talk about where you see the market going and where you see hope and prosperity evolving. So Lynn and Elise, both give a hand off to folks where they can find you online and anything else you guys want to highlight.
So you can find me at linalt.com, active on Twitter at linaltcontact. And thanks for having us. Always a fan to talk to both of you.
Elise?
Stillmark's website is just stillmark.com with links for founders to reach out. And I'm on Twitter at least as an audience to what happens there at Elise Killeen.
We'll have links to all that in the show notes. Ladies, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
If you guys enjoyed this conversation, be sure to follow the show on whatever podcast application you use. Just search for We Study Billionaires. The Bitcoin-specific shows come out every Wednesday, and I'd love to have you as a regular listener. If you enjoyed the show, or you learned something new, or you found it valuable, if you can leave a review, we would really appreciate that, and it's something that helps others find the interview in the search algorithm. So anything you can do to help out with a review, we would just greatly appreciate. And with that, thanks for listening, and I'll catch you again next week.
Thank you for listening to TIP. To access our show notes, courses, or forums, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decisions, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the Investors Podcast Network. Written permissions must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.